Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I am your host, Anna Fishson, and today it's my pleasure to be speaking with Patricia Garavici about her most recent book, Transgender Psychoanalysis, A Lacanian Perspective on Sexual Difference, published by Routledge in 2017, so this year. Dr. Garavici is quite prolific and a regular here on the New Books Network. She's the co-founder and director of the Philadelphia Lacan Group and associate faculty in the Psychoanalytic Studies minor at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also honorary member at the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, or IPTAR, and a member at Après-Coup, a psychoanalytic association both in New York. Patricia is featured in the documentary film Psychoanalysis in El Barrio. For those who have not seen it, it's an excellent film. I highly recommend it. It's on PepWeb. Her books include The Puerto Rican Syndrome, published in 2003, Please Select Your Gender, From the Invention of Hysteria to the Democratizing of Transgenderism, from Routledge, 2010, about which she was interviewed by my colleague Tracy Morgan on this channel. She also has two edited collections so far, both with Manya Steinkohler, Lacan on Madness, Madness, Yes, You Can't, from Routledge, 2015, about which I interviewed her also on this podcast, and Lacan, Psychoanalysis and Comedy, out last year by Cambridge University Press. Patricia, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anna. Happy to be here. And nice really to be called welcome. A regular.
You're right.
So this is the only club one wants to belong to.
Why, thank you. Okay. All right. So let's get to it. I had the opportunity, actually, to read your book, Please Select Your Gender, as well. And like transgender psychoanalysis, it's a very rich, multi-layered account. Much was covered there, including a lot of history and a psychoanalytic theorization of trans memoir writing. So I'm curious why you decided to write another book on this topic. In some ways, I mean, from the perspective of the media, a lot has changed for trans people in the last 5 years or so. Certainly there's an increased visibility and activism. Cis people are better informed, perhaps. Since Trump's election, of course, we've seen an attack on trans rights, most recently to do with serving in the military. Mm-hmm. But please tell us about what changes you perceive and here in the clinic and among psychoanalysts, and tell us if there's been a shift in your thinking since the publication of the earlier book in 2010.
Yes, when I published Please Select Your Gender, that was back in 2010, I didn't know then that I was going to be riding a sort of wave that became something more like a tsunami that has swept away all maybe the perhaps ignorance that non-trans people, that now we can identify them more openly as cis people, the transgender experience became more and more visible. There is something that I already detected in the subtitle of Please Select Your Gender. The handful of the title was the democratizing of transgenderism, because I was already seeing then a mediatic presence of a trans persons that has reached a level that I couldn't have never imagined back then in 2010. So I felt compelled to maybe account for the changes, not only in the social context, which I think had changed, and as you mentioned rightfully, it is still changing and it is still in a very precarious situation. Many of the civil rights achievements of the trans community that were perhaps taken for granted before November 2016, now are being questioned, like the presence of trans persons in the military. So things are constantly shifting, but also there have been important changes from my clinical position. I learned, and again, this is the wonderful thing of the clinical practice, guided by my analysis, I discovered that the way I have approached the trans phenomenon in 2010 would not be the same way I would approach it today. And this is what I develop in this book, that my position from a theoretical perspective has changed in a significant point. I don't know if I could elaborate on that.
Yes, please, please. Sure. I mean, maybe just we'll get into it, I'm sure, but maybe you could just give a little preview now.
The preview was that I was a little maybe skewed in my position. I was, like most psychoanalysts, I was too focused on issues of gender and sexuality. And I didn't realize that behind maybe an apparent complaint, a symptom that seemed to be an issue around simply gender, in fact, there was a much more general, much more universal problem that had to do with issues of existence, that for many transgender people, it's about being able to exist. It's a new way of being, and that related to issues of embodiment, and at times, in some extreme cases, experience as issues of life and death. So that, in a way, transformed dramatically how I think of transgender.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you say that. I remember we were chatting at an event. I mean, I can see that, by the way, that before I say this, that the book is definitely going toward that, and you leave that for the last couple chapters, and you really, that's really much, very much developed in the last, you know, several chapters. But I do remember we were chatting at this event a few years ago, and you told me you were writing this book, and I asked you, I don't know if you remember this, but I asked you then, like, so what's your latest thinking about the process of transitioning? And you said rather sort of enigmatically, or this is what I remembered you saying, that it was about mortality.
Exactly.
And I had this fantasy about your thesis.
Uh-huh.
That I'm not sure is right, but even after reading the book, but let me just sort of, I wonder if you could comment on it. So it seemed to me that you implied that when the body feels alien to oneself, it can feel immortal. That mortality is something we achieve when we assume a sexed body. So paradoxically, when you are a body and you don't have a body, your organs, your skin, bones feel immortal, and your suicide is without consequence. The body exists with or without you. It's not identified with you. And so in transitioning and taking ownership of your body, you become mortal in a way, and perhaps yes, no longer suicidal. Mm-hmm. And you related this to this performance artist whose name escapes me now, but who made a video of their transition.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can. Have I distorted your thesis there, or is
it? Yeah. In a way, that this is the wonderful thing of writing, because in a way, the book is rewritten through the reader, and I'm a very good reader. And indeed, I was feeling all along that the issues that the trans people are putting forward is about mortality, and it's interesting this. One hears that when maybe an analyst says, if I would not have transitioned, I would be dead by now. I would have committed suicide. We could also see that in the very high rate of suicidal attempts within those identified as trans, which is really very shocking. For the general population, the rate of suicide is around 4%. For those who identify as trans, the rate goes up to 41%, which is very worrisome. And as a clinician, this is something that is important to address and to try to account for. And it has to do with what you're saying, that paradoxically, being a body not fully embodied, to make the body come alive, you need to accept the fact that body is mortal. And if we think of suicide, it's a very enigmatic phenomenon, suicide, and every person who is in the desperate situation that may attempt against their life has, nevertheless, often a certain hope that by killing themselves, they're going to solve something, which is unhappily an illusion, because once that person has died, there is no point of return. But there is often, and this is something quite puzzling, that often people before committing suicide may go to the hairdresser, get very well dressed, that there is an idea that this will be a solution that in a way is not such a thing, because then life ends for that person and the situation is not at all solved. But there is this illusion of immortality, that there would be an after that in a way justify the suicidal gesture. And I think that for many people, transition is a way of finding a way to live, a solution, choosing life and not death, which is, I think, something that takes a lot of courage for someone who may feel that up to that point, life is unlivable. And this is one of the ideas that I work in the book, the idea of a livable embodiment. That embodiment makes life livable. And the example you were mentioning of the artist is that I develop in particular in one chapter. Their name is Swift Shakers, who I think has a part of their project is this dumb body carved out of meat. And you can see how a body is reduced not even to organs, just to meat. There is something dehumanized in a body that could become meat, the way we refer to the animals, those who are not vegetarian eat. And so that dumb body carved out of meat could, through this wonderful art project that they have, become a livable flesh and a body that could survive. And that, I think, is a more interesting way of thinking, and in a way points to a sort of universality that any living being, all of us, in a way confront, that in a way what one learns from those who had a presumed gender trouble, the presumed gender trouble of transgender people, is in fact a sort of universal condition. And there is something that has to do with the fact that we all have to confront our own mortality, we all have to inhabit our sexual body, and that in a sense is not the exclusive province of trans persons, but is universal. It's an impossibility that is universal for all people. That there is something in because we speak, because we have language, that we separate from our body, and that for the unconscious, another thing the unconscious has a lot of trouble with is with representing our own mortality, with accepting the fact that we are going to die. We know it, but we pretend we don't, and we forget about it. Mm-hmm. So embodiment has to do maybe with assuming that thing that the unconscious cannot fully represent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yeah, so as you just said, we all as speaking beings have trouble assuming a body. But nonetheless, I mean, are there specific issues at stake for your trans patients, though, that hinge on the symbolization of sex having rather than being a body, and the nodding of what Lacan calls the symptom? Is this something that is, maybe you can explain what the symptom is. Is this something unique to trans experience, or is this something that we can, universalize? And if we universalize it, as you say, do we risk kind of erasing the trans, or do we, it's this kind of problem we often have with, making something, theorizing a certain kind of phenomenology or a certain experience, and the danger of then losing its uniqueness, losing a sense of its uniqueness.
Yeah, that's why one of the titles of the chapters in the book is the singular universality of trans, which is this paradox. How could you be at the same time universal and singular? But this is exactly how, in a way, we could think about every time we have a new analysis on the couch is somebody unique, singular, and that will never be repeated. On the other hand, there are certain structural elements, there are certain cultural and historical overdeterminations that exceed and could be seen in more than one specific case and could be repeated. And in that sense, for instance, the unconscious impossibility of representation of sexuality or of mortality is something that anyone who speaks will have trouble with. So in that sense, it is universal. The way each person will experience that trouble will be unique, and it will have a specific presentation, and the way it would be ignored by the subject, the way it will be maybe rediscovered, reclaimed, suffered, or overcome, it will be specific to one person in particular, which is, I think, the, for instance, if we pick up one famous phrase of Lacan, the unconscious structure like a language, we think that indeed language is a universal structure. Nobody owns language. Nobody can suddenly decide to change language. One is born into a language that precedes one's arrival into the life, and it will survive one's own life. So there is this external and social sphere. At the same time, it's unique how each person will be affected by language, how each unconscious will be structured, how trauma will be inscribed for every specific person. And regarding trans, I find it very illustrative. That's why the title of the book is Transgender Psychoanalysis. In a way, what I try to say to psychoanalysts is that if we keep analytically or alerted ears, if we pay attention to what the trans experience is saying, we may be able to see something that is not only for trans people, but for everyone else. And in that sense, what my strategy there is to try to depathologize the trans experience. Because unhappily, psychoanalysis has a very bad record of pathologizing non-normative expressions of sexuality. For a long time, for instance, homosexuality was considered a terrible pathology that needed to be cured. And in a way, psychoanalysts seem to have forgotten basic psychoanalytic ideas put forward by Freud, saying that heterosexuality and homosexuality are equally contingent object choices, and we cannot account for either of them, and neither homosexuality nor heterosexuality can be considered more normal or less normal or even a model of health. They are just contingent outcomes. And in the same way, I think what by universalizing the trans experience, what I'm trying to say is let's forget the pathology. This is not an exception, but this is one possible outcome. I don't know if that is not a pathology in the sense of a deviation, but that rather, if there is a norm, it is deviation itself. Mm-hmm. Every case is exceptional in a sense, using that. Yeah.
Right. I mean, actually, you know, so last fall, a few of us at IPTAR hosted a workshop on transgender identities, and you were one of the presenters invited to speak, and you said something very similar, you know, then, because you were talking about your book. That many analysts, you know, still assume that transgender expression indicates an underlying pathology, like like psychosis, even, or borderline disorders, and that many cis analysts, you know, with some notable exceptions, are sort of still woefully ignorant about the challenges of transition, and not always sensitive to the daily physical threat and discrimination faced by trans and gender fluid people. So, but still, I mean, you know, again, as you point out in the book, actually, you say that many trans people do go to therapy, that they're in some form of talk therapy despite being dissatisfied with it, and then they avoid, sometimes some avoid psychoanalysis because they feel rejected, understandably, by it or misunderstood. So maybe I'm just wondering how you see. Maybe something. Please tell our listeners what psychoanalysis, or specifically Lacanian psychoanalysis, has to offer trans-identified people as opposed to other treatment modalities. Because I feel like there's just a lot of resistance because psychoanalysis, as you said, is just not has not been very kind
Yeah, has not been, but it kind of has been in a way the what I found doing some research that most trans people describe their experience with psychoanalysis as catastrophic. And indeed, when you are rejected to the level of pathology and abjection, your experience cannot be really very positive. On the other hand, I think psychoanalysis, and this would be maybe we need to make a differentiation between the institutionalization of psychoanalysis and maybe the medicalization of psychoanalysis, that the history of psychoanalysis was, in a way, the potential of psychoanalytic theory had been, in a way, limited and unhappily the clinical practice distorted by the psychoanalytic institutions. But if you maybe go back to early psychoanalytic texts, Freud's three essays on sexual theory, you have there elements that could allow you to think about sexuality, about gender, in ways that could be extremely helpful for those who may experience what we may call gender trouble, who may have trans experience, that psychoanalysis has that potential. And what I discovered, to my surprise, doing research for the book, was that early on in the history of psychoanalysis, what then became the clinic of a sex change and the early psychoanalyst, the first psychoanalyst in the world, and they were, and even Freud himself was extremely interested in sexology at the time, was interested in, and he discusses, if you look at Freud's complete works, you find many references to the works of his then contemporary Steiner, who was a pioneer in the clinic of sex change, that psychoanalysis and what we may call transgender discourse were collaborating closely at the beginning of the 20th century. And unhappily, because of the prejudice, personal prejudice of psychoanalysts, that collaboration was cut short. But that there is, I think, in psychoanalytic theory an ethics of sexual difference, in particular in the Lacanian modality, with what you mentioned in passing, the notion of the symptom, which is a symptom that is no longer a symptom as a pathology, but rather a creative solution. If we think that a symptom could be something that could make life livable, and Lacan uses an old archaic orthography of the word symptom and calls it symptom, is still a symptom in the sense of maybe being a compromised solution, as Freud called symptom, but a symptom that is no longer something to get rid of, something that could maybe make you suffer, but rather something that could allow you to live. And that would go back to what we were discussing before about mortality and finding ways of being, that maybe being transgender, like being cis or being identified with maybe in between the binary of genders, could be ways of being that allow someone to live in their body. And this, I think psychoanalysis can think that way and can hear that way, that even if we look at the fundamental rules, say whatever comes to mind is regarding whether or not it's inconvenient, offensive, allows for that freedom that could be extremely helpful for someone who may have a transgender expression, for instance.
Mm-hmm. You know, this brings me to something. When we speak about, I'm not being coy here. When we speak about trans, what are we even speaking about? Because, you know, you say this a couple of times in your book and you just mentioned non-binary identification. You know, like Schreber, Laverne Cox, Caitlyn Jenner, Kraft Ebbings, patients from the 19th century. You know, they can all be called trans, but is it fruitful to place them together? I was wondering, like, because also, you know, it's my impression, and it could just be my impression, that more people than, say, 5 years ago or in 2010 are choosing to identify as gender fluid or gender, you know, or trans, but not male or female. So fewer people say today things like, I was born in the wrong body, or I have a female brain, like, but otherwise a male anatomy, as Jenner once said. More people insist on a non-binary identification. Do you think it's becoming harder to generalize about transgender experience or expression? What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, what I was thinking, for instance, that when, because one way with the famous case of Schreber, who felt that suddenly he felt that he was, all his life, he had lived male identified, he had lived as a man, and all of a sudden he felt that he was becoming a woman, but not just any woman. He was going to become God's wife. He ended up institutionalized with the diagnosis of paranoia. He managed to fight back. He wrote his memoirs, and by way of the memoirs, he was able to go on trial and prove that he could live in society, that he didn't need to be institutionalized. And as one thought I had, would Schreber have been born today? Maybe, if he could have lived a trans life freely. And I think that we are in moments of change, and unhappily, many of the civil rights advancements that we were almost taken for granted as permanent changes are being challenged, like the inclusion of trans persons in the military, in the case of the US. I'm thinking that perhaps this democratizing of the trans phenomena in a way could allow those who cannot identify clearly as male or female, or can, that the binary that may work for some cis person may not, they may not feel identified with that, they may not feel represented, could find a way to exist. And my impression is that there is a positive aspect in this democratizing of the trans experience. That and indeed, I think that the difficulty we may have in universalizing, in the sense that if we use the idea of universalization to erase difference and uniqueness, then we are maybe reproducing a sort of fascistic model. If we use the idea of universalization to maybe account for something that may be structural rather than a deviance, because often, and this is some big scene of psychoanalysis, something new, something different has been considered pathological, wrong, that needed to be corrected, rather than maybe seeing it as one possible way of embodiment. And in that sense, it's interesting, even in the terminology we're sharing, we no longer think in terms of a healthy, normal, abnormal, but rather possibilities, contingent possibilities. And in that sense, I applaud personally the democratization of trans, because it allows for many people perhaps to have a life. And some of the research done recently has identified, on the one hand, the statistics, sovereign statistics I was talking about, 41% suicidal rate. We have that. On the other hand, we have some studies that there are these transnational studies done in several geographical locations, Canada, Mexico, and I think many different countries. I don't recall exactly the list, but it has been widely researched, the fact that for many trans-identified people, the main source of psychic suffering was the pathologization of their experience. That there wasn't. It is important. I think we have a responsibility, an ethical responsibility, as practitioners, not to jump onto pathologization before we hear where is this person talking from. What is this accounting for? And if you are talking about a symptom, maybe it could be something they bring to the treatment and want to get rid of. But if we are talking about a symptom, maybe this is a solution they found to make life livable. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it betrays a certain artistry, a certain know-how that lets them live a life. And this is something quite creative and admirable. So we are, in a way, thinking I think psychoanalysis allow us to see and think about the clinical practice in a way that we could easily avoid falling into simplifications, because I think certain jumping into saying, oh, everyone who is trans has to be psychotic, is making too simple and too easy something that may, on the other hand, require a little more careful listening, a little more thinking. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, you say this in the book, that there are psychotic, perverse, and neurotic trans people, just like there are perverse, neurotic, psychotic cis people, right?
Yes, so, absolutely, yes.
So, but on the other hand, but this is, again, we're, this is the trick, though, also, that you say, you know, trans people, you know, teach psychoanalysis something, so if we're trying to productively kind of theorize a trans structure, can we think about it as a structure, or is it... Because the centomic construction could be, you know, it could be mine, yours, anybody's. So that, you know, I was thinking, can we locate trans in like Lacan's sexuation formula? You know, can we somehow or think about it as something akin to a hysterical structure? Or, you know, so I think in the book there does seem to be some ambiguity there or ambivalence about, you know, going going in that direction. Fully, like you sort of intimate it, but then you pull back from ultimately kind of theorizing it.
I don't believe that there is such a thing as a trans structure. I believe that there are trans symptoms. And again, I think of them in symptoms as manifestations. Mm-hmm. And that could be, for some people, could be a source of tremendous suffering. Maybe someone who may have a psychotic structure, and I have encountered that in my practice, may experience something that sort of drive into becoming, in case where cis, I'm thinking of two or three cases in particular that have right now in my mind, that they were thinking that even though they were born and identify and assign as male, they felt they were becoming women, and there was this sort of push, sort of drive that was making their life terrible, and they were suffering a lot. So in that sense, it was a symptom that was making their life very difficult. On the other hand, I had heard many times that if I would not have transitioned, I would be dead. So then becoming trans was a way of living, a way of embodying their body, it's a solution in the sense of finding a way to be that was not allowed before. So what I would rather say, and I hope I made that clear in the book, perhaps not, is that I think of trans symptoms, not a trans structure. And as symptoms, one may find people talking of trans expressions within a structure of so-called normality, and I would ascribe to that a hysteric structure, or someone with an obsessional and neurotic structure, again, neurotic, so-called normal, or somebody with a perverse structure. So that I could not find a way of thinking exclusively of a trans structure, but there are ways of being that could be experienced in different psychic structures. There is no one specific structure. In that sense, I disagree with most Lacanian analysts. We go back to the person who first systematized the idea of what was called then transsexualism, Catherine Millon. She seems to imply that everyone with a trans expression is psychotic. And I fully disagree. And unhappily, I thought this is something she thought in the 80s. Many people, especially in the English-speaking world, have entered into a dialogical criticism and have wrote back. And she's still in her recent memoir, which was very recently published, My Life with Lacan. She again makes the same mistake, and she has what I feel is a misreading of a famous interview of Lacan with someone who identifies as someone who could be at times male and at times could feel like being female. as someone who could not, should not undergo a sex change, because nobody undergoing a surgery could become a real woman, and if such a thing could ever exist, which sounds very anti-Lacanian. I don't think Lacanian, Lacan, who would say, could, one of his famous phrases was "the woman does not exist," would have ever said, "you will not become a real woman." So maybe you could feel like a real woman, but never become an in existence, to quote the title of the song. So I think it's important to think of expressions. I think you use that word, and it's a welcome one. There are trans expressions in many psychic structures. I couldn't find a sort of a unique structure to all of them.
Right. Yeah. You do use the term transgender discourse.
Yes. And it's important, because I would say transgender discourse, talking about maybe what is produced in culture, what we read in the newspaper, and that made my completing this book a little bit of a nightmare, because this tsunami I referred to at the beginning of our conversation was that every day with my breakfast coffee, I would open the New York Times, and every day there was something on the news about someone trans or a trans-related issue. That would be one aspect of the transgender discourse. And then there is the transgender discourse in terms of what is being published. Transgender discourse, maybe what brought, as you mentioned earlier, is a wonderful event at IPTAR that was extremely well attended. And there, I felt very happy after that Sunday, because I heard analysts who were in a way aware of this complicated history, and they wanted to talk about these issues, to rethink, and to be ready to welcome in the practice people with these kind of presentations without continue making the mistakes of the olden times. And I think that that's in itself a good ethical psychoanalytic position, that one could learn from the experience and let themselves be guided by what the analysis bring. Which is, I think, what makes our work very interesting, that the couch is a sort of window to what happens in society, and that would be what I call discourse, that we see things happening at times 5 or 10 years before we will read about them in the New York Times.
Let me just maybe switch it up a little bit from discourse to, well, this is related. Let's talk a little bit about aesthetics. There's a big part of the book, and I don't want to sort of forget about this part, deals with beauty, plasticity, and you link that to mortality, embodiment, and you think all of these things together, and you say that your trans patients have sort of enabled you to make these connections. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I started being intrigued by the fact that often the bodily transformation for those who may move from one gender to another was always predicated under the idea of being beautiful, that somehow beauty granted a sense of maybe security, could allow the person to pass. And I was wondering, what kind of beauty were we talking about? Was the beauty of maybe a denial of castration, a beauty that was hiding the fact that we'll die? Or on the other hand, maybe something about the fleeting quality of beauty? Because maybe when we look at a flower and we look at it and we are moved by its beauty, it's also because we know that that beautiful flower will fade, and that what we are admiring is something very transient. So that in a way, what could have been read as a beauty as a sort of mask, as trying to conceal the fact that maybe behind the very well done makeup or the beautiful muscles and the perfect chest, there is also this fleeting quality that, precisely when we're talking about embodiment, could allow us to relate to the fact that that beauty will not be there forever. That something that is beautiful because it will end. But what's also interesting that our aesthetic pleasure and admiration of beauty is something that is pleasurable, that it creates a good feeling. So in a way, allow us to tolerate the fact that that beautiful flower with faith, because it is beautiful now. So it allow us also to relate to temporality differently.
Well, yeah, and with actually with regard to beauty, to take it back to the sort of trans patients, I noticed in the book, for whatever reason, that your patients are mostly, when you give your own cases, they're mostly trans men, and the trans women in the book tend to be sort of celebrities and who are very focused on beauty or historical cases. So, and yet you often, you know, you write as many do, as if there was like a symmetry or homology between the issues and experiences of trans men and trans women. So if we were to sort of, I wanted to question this a little bit. I mean, do you think that there might be an asymmetry in the experience or difference? Because, I mean, even on the experiential level, right, there seems to be a potential asymmetry, since if you transition from male to female in our culture, you lose status, for one thing. The parameters of sort of realness, so-called, are narrower for both cis and trans women. So the criteria for beauty and imperatives of femininity, et cetera, you know, they require access to plastic surgery, fashion. So issues of class figure more prominently for trans women than maybe trans men. I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of throwing it out there that there's, and that there's more of a threat of violence potentially just walking down the street for a trans woman than for a trans man, maybe. So this is the experiential asymmetry, but maybe there are other asymmetries, like, you know, this you reference Lacan's famous pronouncement, woman does not exist. You know, is there something more difficult about transitioning, you know, in that direction to becoming a woman?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't aware, because I as I was writing, I brought up examples that could relate to whatever issue I was discussing in each particular chapter. And it occurs to me now, talking with you, that perhaps I may have unconsciously chosen to represent more cases of trans men, because they seem to have been more invisible. There is much more written about trans women that it has been about trans men, and often trans men, I don't think there is a symmetry in the experience, because I haven't found, as I told you before, I haven't found a trans structure where I could talk about this is what the trans experience is about. I would need, this is what the trans experience was for this person, and this was the trans experience for this other analysis. And this, I think, is the wonderful thing of our clinical work, that each case is, it's a new case. And Freud, when he said you need to relearn psychoanalysis every time you meet a patient, and every new patient is a whole universe in that sense, if we were talking about universalization. And perhaps in terms of class, yes, it is true. I agree with you that probably a trans woman of color would have more chances of being killed for being a trans woman than maybe a trans white man, and that maybe... I was recently given the reverse anecdote that would confirm one of your points, that was a trans woman who was in the doing science, and somebody runs into her and identifies the last name and said, "Oh, I read work by your brother." But his work was stronger than yours. Because. Wow. Because it's, and the reverse as well, that when the work was for now a trans man, is, oh, your work is stronger, whereas the work of your sister wasn't as good. So it's very interesting how, in a way, social prejudice continues and is not stopped by the trans experience. So indeed, the unique experience of transition will not be the same because we live in a society that ascribes to each gender certain attributions that have been very questioned by research, by science, by many studies, but they continue to exist. So in that sense, and the cases, what I found that is interesting in terms of class, it is true that maybe it's more visible the issue of beauty for trans women, or this certain expectation that the trans woman should look in a certain way. But this is also maybe distorted by the public eye that, for instance, if we look at Caitlyn Jenner as the model of a trans woman, it is one type of trans woman. I have had trans women in my practice that may embody a different form of femininity. They are it's a different way of being a woman. And in that sense, we go back to the phrase, the woman does not exist because there are women, not the woman. Maybe I'm tempted to coin, with your help, the idea the transsexual does not exist. There are transsexuals. So for some, the embodiment may be very important. I had worked with trans men for whom it was extremely important to have a perfect chest, big muscles, and look extremely fit. And for others, it was just being comfortable in their bodies, and they didn't need to be lifting weights every day and be maybe fitting in a specific form of masculinity. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, there is no universal. And in that sense, going back to the formula of sexuation, what is interesting, and that's one maybe big issue, perhaps impossible for us to cover today, but one interesting thing for psychoanalysis that we can learn from the trans experience, I always say learn from transgender and not apply psychoanalysis to transgender people, that we learn is that when Lacan talks about sexuation, he talks about ways of being that are not overdetermined by body contours, but the way one may relate to this very controversial notion of the phallus. And often trans people can assume a sexual embodiment without fully relying on the phallus. And that's very original in terms of how to think psychoanalytically and also politically, because it escapes all these mandates. In a way, certain forms of femininity could be very phallic. And there are other forms of femininity that are not all subjected to the phallus.
So, also then, in a sense, yes? You have named a kind of structural aspect of trans, potentially, just mm-hmm. a way of, I don't want to overgeneralize, you know, it's not my intention to talk about trans experience as a monolithic anything, mm-hmm. believe me, but yeah, just something in the, is to be able to talk about these experiences in a way that might be, you know, productive theoretically. I think that's a perfect way. So there's a way of evading the phallic, the relationship to the phallus, maybe.
Mm-hmm. A way of thinking about sexual difference without fully relying on the phallus. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, something very intriguing for people working on gender studies and people who may want to think of different forms of sexuality.
Right. Yeah. You know, there's one issue that this makes me, you know, the singularity of each case, your emphasis on this makes me think of this clinical issue that trans analysants sort of report, and you know, there's this danger that it seems to me like, and Avgi Sakatapulu, Griff, Hansberry, Jack Pula, they've written or talked about this in their own ways, that when a trans person is in analysis, the counter-transference is such that all of their problems get linked to being trans. So, for example, if they have problems with, you know, dependency, aggression, that's because they're trans, or they have narcissistic issues, it's like linked to the transition. So, transition. I mean, what do you think about this? Is this a problem for trans patients? I mean, obviously, maybe not with you, but do you hear about this?
I think it's a problem for the analysts.
Yeah, exactly.
Why I insist on transgender psychoanalysis. I think the way you describe it sounds like the analyst is only able to listen to the analytic material in a certain way without maybe seeing why is this analyst talking about this, and it may or may not be related to the transition. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you have some very keen describers of the trans experience, like Jay Prosser, who says that transitioning is something as consuming as a career. It's not a consumeristic lifestyle choice. Oh, I move to the suburbs, I become vegan, I change my sex. Not at all. It is totally all-consuming. And this could maybe distract an experienced analyst, but if the analyst is careful and listening, could maybe hear that maybe for this analyst, the transition is something very important, but this life may not be reduced only to that. There may be other things going on. And that maybe they need to be paid attention to in the dimension that may occupy. In a way, it's as if their fascination, and that's why I was saying a problem for the analyst, that they may get fascinated with the trans expression and forget and stop being able to listen to what is that this analyst is talking about.
Right. You're right. Yeah. I think that is a problem.
And in that sense, I think it is important maybe to overcome a sort of temptation to fetishize the trans experience. And that's why maybe I insist on these ideas of universalization, that the trans experience is a way of seeing more clearly something that in a way we can see in many other forms of embodiment. So it is not something to get so hooked on, and maybe should not be a reason to become deaf in the office.
Right. No, that's a very, I think, important message for people. Okay, so we're almost out of time, but before we go, I wanted to ask you if you're working on anything now.
Yeah, I was quietly laughing when you said, so far two collections I'm working on. Yes, exactly, on two more edited collections. One that is connected with, you mentioned, is a wonderful documentary by Basia Vinograd. There is a little clip available on YouTube, a teaser, and also available for free on PEP Web, and then the whole documentary is available for downloading. And now PEP offers a sort of day pass like Netflix. So for those who may not have a PEP subscription, could still have access to this really wonderful documentary, because it has many interesting testimonies of clinicians doing psychoanalysis in the barrio, but also interesting interviews on the sidewalk in the barrio from people. And you see there how open they are to psychoanalytic interventions, and I go back to this phrase I said many times, that people may be poor, but they're not too poor, they cannot afford to have an unconscious. So as an offspring of that, with Chris Christian, we are working on a collection on psychoanalysis in the barrios with contributions by clinicians, cultural historians, anthropologists, to maybe expand a sort of companion to what the experience of psychoanalysis in El Barrio is describing that documentary. And another project I have also with my collaborator, Manya Steinkohler, with whom we did Lacan on Madness and Lacan Psychoanalysis and Comedy, precisely dealing with issues of gender and sexuality from a psychoanalytic perspective, because it felt maybe 2 years ago we would have thought that to discuss gender, sexuality, even the ideas of feminism, it was not necessary anymore. And happily, these things are now have resurged with an urgency that we could not have imagined a year ago. So this is in another collection we are working on. So I have other, and there are other projects in the back burner, but when they come through, they're more evolved. I think I'll be quite busy with these two collections for the time being.
So. Right. Well, it's exciting. Maybe you'll come back to the show. You can come back at any time.
It would be lovely to.
Okay. Great. I've been talking to Patricia Garavici about her book, Transgender Psychoanalysis, A Lacanian Perspective on Sexual Difference. Thank you again, Patricia.
Thank you, Anna. It's been a great pleasure.
Great. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Till next time.